Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. We're also on BitChute and YouTube. I'm also a podcasting coach because I've got 5 podcasts, 4 of them being in the top 0.5%. And you'll find everything on bio.link/podcaster. Today, my guest, also a podcaster, not just one, but he's got 2. He's a serial entrepreneur. He's got 15 different businesses at some stage in different industries and a speaker as well. Please welcome Joseph Rocky.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you.
No problem. So, I mean, I've given a brief introduction, but you might let the listeners know who's Joe.
Yeah, so let's start with the podcasting side, because obviously this is geared towards other podcasters. My first podcast, I started in 2017. It's called Father and Joe, so way back in the day. And what we do in that is that's a relationship-based podcast where we're talking about the need to have better relationships with ourselves, better relationships with those around us, and all underneath the umbrella of the relationship that we share with God. You think doing all these podcasts, I want to be stumbling over my own words. And then the second podcast I did, I took a very right-hand turn from that. I launched it here in September of this year. It's my first one where I dove into the YouTube space as well. And that's called Local Football Flavor, where basically we talk to fans at every fan base around the NFL to see what it's like to learn the tendencies of your team. And there's all kinds of great benefits that come out of that. But most of all, the more you learn about someone else, the funner the league becomes. Like when you learn what the Bills do to the Patriots and how they treat each other and how the Steelers and the Ravens interact and all these other things makes it a much better, complete picture of the NFL once you get outside the bubble of just your own unique team. And we absolutely love sharing the information. Those two are fantastic. In terms of the other space I do all kinds of business consulting, business coaching, keynote addressing, and that has been in virtually every industry you can imagine. I have been there in some capacity from a strategic mental standpoint. So that's a very quick overview, and here I am.
Yeah, I'm just on the second part, because I saw the first podcast, I think, is a 301 episode, so congratulations on that. That's a nice milestone, because there's a lot of people, they throw in the towel fairly early, so you're in for the long haul. With the other one, are you actually taking, because I've seen your YouTube channel, are you actually doing a live and taking that as the podcast then as well, or is it something different that's on?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, long story short, yes. So there are 4 main shows that we do on our channel. We do the pre-recorded guest interviews, because it's just easier whenever you're talking to someone for scheduling standpoint to do that pre-recorded. We do 2 live shows every week. One is based upon the fantasy football element. The other one's based upon the gambling side of the world. One comes out normally on Tuesday. The other one's always on Friday. And then the 4th show is where we break down the coach's film, showing what actually happened on the field. And then we break that down. And those come out sporadically based upon, what are the good games we want to talk about? And also, you know, where is the ability? Because that's a very time-consuming process. But with the playoffs starting here on Sunday, there's going to be a lot of those coming out. I can definitely assure you of that. And to all of the Cowboys fans, I don't hate you. You just don't play good against the Eagles. I'm sorry.
I seen, like, obviously you're doing a lot of keynotes and everything, but I'd like to know, Joe is a young boy, what's your speaking journey?
So the speaking journey is a fun one. I started in sales my whole life, which is really kind of speaking in of itself, just in a different format. But when I was in college, I did debate. I eventually became an All-American debater. And literally you're judged on the things that come out of your face, and that's it. I think it was a nice compliment to, I'd already started my sales career at that point. I liked just basically having more practice talking to people. So that's where I believe the true origin of my speaking career, if you will, began. Obviously the podcast kicking off in 2017 is more practice behind a microphone, but really where it took off was COVID. Because everyone was stuck inside, and I just started dabbling with digital talks. And I just started getting into it very slowly, presenting people on the ability how to sell, presenting people on how to create your business structure. And it started digitally, like I said, being born out of COVID. And now we're at a point where it's like, you know what? I was good at this. I've never had a disfavorable review. I know the information I've given to people has made their businesses more profitable. There's I can't even tell you how many people have told me it has made their lives better outside of the business realm, like actually making them personally better at home and in the other facets of their lives. And to me, that was like so much more motivating than the dollars and cents that I was making in my other businesses. So the keynote speaking address of my business is really what we're hitting hard here in 2023. I want to go to much more of a higher level, higher profile. And also now that the world is opening up, I want to start doing these in person and much more. I've only done three of them in person, but I want to do much more of them where I'm traveling to warm places, because while Pittsburgh is a great place, it's cold. There's just no way around that. And if I can be somewhere where it's warm and a beach, that would be awesome. So that's the goal of what we're looking for here.
Excellent, excellent. And with the debating, because like I've heard, it's a fantastic advantage to do. Is it a case of you were doing it in teams or individually? And did they switch it around? Because sometimes I've heard of where they'd give you a topic and you have to do the pro and the con of it. Like, what's your experience? What way was it done? And would you have tips for people that actually, you know, are trying to get into the debating?
So I did it both as individual and as part of a two-man team, so a duo. And yes, I've done it both ways, where you are told this is the topic. You will need to have a pre-prepared argument for both sides of the fence. And then I've also done, which I think I prefer more, the one where all of the debaters are in the same space. And 10 minutes before your debate, you are told this is what your topic is. This is what side of the fence you are. Have fun. And basically you're going from 10 minutes from more or less pre-known knowledge. Google does exist and you can do some things on your phone, but to be able to truly make a good concrete argument, you gotta have some pre-knowledge on things. And in general, they were very common topics that you would have known about anyway. I mean, they were almost always about political nature that was going on in life, or just general core value type questions that you would have. You may have heard of the subway paradigm, or the trolley paradigm, I guess was technically called, where the trolley's out of control. You can save the people that are going to get run over by this trolley if you kill one person on the trolley. What do you do? So on the one hand, you save 30 people, but you have to murder one. On the other hand, you don't murder anyone, but the train's going to run over 30 people. So that's the type of value paradox that we would have to go through and fight both sides of. And you'd be told what side. So like whatever your personal bias was, didn't matter. You had to make a coherent argument. And truly, that's how you learn more about your own beliefs anyway. You learn what the other side is. And it's one of the things I personally believe the world is lacking now, trying to understand where the other side is coming from in a coherent way.
No, definitely. I think if you can actually understand where someone's coming from, you can have a better conversation where it stops. Because, I mean, there's even fighting in the house these days with you know, people having different opinions. And with that, like, was it a kind of two-minute conversation, or how long would you have to debate for? What's the duration?
Now you're asking me questions. Remember when I was 20? From what I recall, it was basically on the ones where we knew the topic in advance. Each one of the four people had 10 minutes each or so, a little bit of back and forth after their questions. And then the second half was no new information, just pure response to what was already thrown at you. So you basically talked for 20-ish minutes overall. The whole thing took a little bit under 2 hours. And the second way really depended upon where you were at. How long did they give you? The structure was still the guy who's the pro, the agenda goes first. The second guy goes against it, gets a little bit longer. Then the first guy goes again. So those were normally, I'm working through it in my head, the math of it. Those were probably only about an hour, but it was only you and one other person. There was no teammate. So that's the difference. So it's all on your feet, thinking about what do I need to say, trying to be coherent and making a valid argument, and also reading the judges out there to see what points you have that landed and what points didn't land. Most of the people who went through this with me are lawyers now, because that's what it essentially was training for people in law school. And I just happened to be in there as an accounting and finance major because I like doing it.
Excellent. I mean, obviously, it's helped you in sales. So, like I've read, it's something like 15 different things that you've worked on. So, what's kind of, I know that some of them are real estate based work. So, what are the kind of different industries that you've worked in? And then you might kind of touch on kind of building a different business, just for those that are trying to, aspire to have something like that.
So for those who are aspiring to create a business, whether it be a podcast, real estate, I want to create a mining company, it doesn't really matter what it is, that there's three aspects of every business you need to have with, and it's the sales cycle. The first thing you need to have is people know what your business is and have a desire to want to be a part of it. The second is when they arrive at your business, they want to be there. And if they're an employee, they want to be there to work. And if they're a customer, they want to be there to give you money. And on the final back end, you have to be able to deliver what you're promising and from an operational standpoint. So if we look at this specifically in the realm of podcasting, as you're aware here, the first thing is people need to be able to find us. Is our logo, is our tech titles, is our description, all that actually well written? Doing the bare minimum, putting in two words in the description so that the directories don't yell at us, so they'll post it. Or are we putting some actually good content in there? And then, in terms of when they get here, do they want to be here? Is the sound quality good? Or are they hearing static and hisses? And it's the one guy like 20 times louder than the other guy? Or are we actually like built correctly so it sounds good and we want to stay? And then, obviously, the third portion is the quality of this podcast there? So that's the framework of any business. And then to answer how do we do within it, you need to know what you're best at because there is no personality type that can do all three of those. It doesn't exist. You can take every mental person is capable of doing all of them, but you're not naturally inclined to want to because there are polar opposite requirements. So what I recommend to everyone is first figure out what you're really good at. For the majority of people, it's going to be on that back end making a really awesome product, which is great. But you need to be able to pair up with individuals who can do the other parts, or you're going to have to just suck up and deal with it. And where a lot of people get burnt out, as you said in the beginning here, that doing 300 episodes, 5 years worth of podcasting is super impressive. Sure, right, because people quit. And it's because they're so focusing on making the good content, they never do the research and the time that's required to make your podcast findable. And then you get burned out from lack of results because, hey, I just basically gave everyone the cure to cancer, but no one wants to listen to it. That is incredibly frustrating. I get it. I was there, and it wasn't really until I learned how to find companies that would help me out with how to get my podcast found. I mean, I have no idea how search optimization works. I mean, that was completely foreign term to me. And now I hired a company. They do all this stuff for me. They'd say, hey, Joe, instead of writing the sentence this way, write it this way. To me, it sounds basically the same, but apparently the internet loves it. I don't know why, to a degree. I don't really care why. I just need to do it. And that's how I look at that with businesses. You don't need to know exactly what the other funnels are doing. As long as you're all in harmony and liking each other, it will take care of itself.
Excellent. And with kind of building a sales team then, whether it's real estate or something like that, what kind of tips would you have for that?
So the first thing with any sales component is you need to have people that are motivated. Oh, this is really for any position. You need to have people that are motivated based upon what they are doing. So as the manager, business owner, whatever title you have, this power, what you want to do is have people compensated based upon the outcomes that you want. I mean, in America, the standard default setting is we're either going to pay you an hourly rate or a salary, and that's just what you're going to get regardless of what your output is. And that's a horrible, horrible situation. But everyone does it because it's what everyone else does, and it's easy. And I don't want to stand out. And I want to be weird. I'm going to get employees. No, that's all stupid. What you want is you want to have you get paid when you make the sale because that's what's important. And how we get there, we're going to have obviously ethical guidelines to get you there, and we'll train you to make it. But at the end of the day, you're paid based upon the success of your outcomes. So my answer would be you want to find someone who works ideally 100% on commission, but as much on commission as you can find for your space. because that will show that that person is motivated and hungry. And also on that side note, if they do fail, you didn't lose any money. So it's less of a risk to you, but anytime there's less of a risk to you in that capacity, you're going to be paying a bigger check on the back end. But as I always like to remind people, you're making money. So the more that you pay your commission, the more money you ultimately made. So it's not that cutting a big check should be scary. It's actually something you should be glad to do because you're getting more revenue pulled in. So to answer your question more succinctly, find people who are comfortable working on. Did I cut out on you there?
What I see, especially in America, but I see it's in a lot of Europe now as well, as they get the interns to, and I just think it's an abuse of a person. And what somebody said to me recently, and I thought, ooh, that's an interesting one, is he said, it's all the rich people that can actually afford to do that, because anybody that's not from a rich family, they don't have the capacity, because not only do you have to transport yourself there, but sometimes if you're in a different city, you have the accommodation and everything. But even if you're in the same city, it's not that easy to do it. So you're kind of limiting and you're keeping a certain side. Just what's your thoughts on kind of the internship?
So let's start with the fundamental fact. Sales are incredibly hard. And the vast majority of people will not succeed at it because you get rejected constantly. People take things personally, and it's just a hard way to live, especially when you're in your 20s, which most interns are. You're unsure of life as it is from an emotional standpoint, and you're getting rejected constantly at work. It's just not a very conducive way to have people say, I want to ride on these waters. So my starting point to that is it's already a hard enough gig. In terms of your answer about it being difficult for people to enter in from social systems, that is true. That's why as a company hiring salespeople, you need to be able to have a system where the pipeline process in duration is shrunk down initially. So whether that be we already have a veteran sales team and we're bringing on a junior member where they don't get paid nearly as much as us, but at least they're getting some stuff built in where they're able to build up their own pathway. As a company, that's how you solve this. I personally believe there is no greater vehicle in terms of professions out there to get yourself out of poverty than sales. And the reason being of if you're in a appropriately commissioned position, you will be able to literally write your own paycheck. And yes, there are some companies out there, and I see what you're saying in terms of you need to have a starting base to be able to get there. But as a company, what I look for is people that are hungry rather than starting with family wealth or personal wealth already entering it. And the notion of starting with a junior salesperson, someone just starting on, pairing with a more veteran one is the easiest way normally to help people over that gap. Because there's a lot of learning curves that go along with the sales side that you need to overcome. But also oftentimes, sales departments are not trimmed to efficiency like they should be. And these more senior salespeople are dealing with a lot of items on their table that aren't profitable, but for whatever reason they have to do. As a company and business structure, I would advise to get rid of those. But say you're in a situation where you haven't done that yet, you let the underling do it, do the stuff that you don't want to do as the senior salesperson, and still compensate them on the commission route coming through. So as a business, that's how I would solve it. For businesses that aren't doing it, you are really holding yourself back. Because what I have found is the hungriest people are the ones that literally are hungry, and they will work the hardest to be able to make the sales happen if you can teach them the right way to do it. And I mean, you look around the stories around people who have gone from poverty to insane wealth, the vast majority of them did it through some component of sales, if not entirely through sales. And that's why I believe the proof is in the pudding. This is the best way to go from nothing to being able to control your own life financially forever.
Excellent. And With the training then, because I mean, I just from people that I talked to, I haven't worked in a position like that, but I've talked to people that have done it. And some companies, they just kind of go on a numbers basis. They bring them in, you sink or swim, good luck. Others train them properly, but then others make the mistake of their best salesperson, they make them the manager. And sometimes the person doesn't want to be the manager, or else they're a terrible manager. So kind of, you might touch on that kind of.
Sure. So all of those are real and they are problems. So the problem of catching 5,000 fish and hoping two live is A, the worst thing you can do for corporate morale, because you're going to have all kinds of people that were in the process that were like, if they would have had a little bit extra, they would have been able to succeed and move through it. But they're surrounded by these masses that are just falling back and eventually disappearing. And it's easier to go with the majority. So you actually are taking people that could be potentially good salespeople and, sabotaging them essentially because you're putting them in a culture of failure. And anytime you're creating a culture of failure, that's not good. Why would you want that for your business? So I am 100% against the model of bring in 5 million people and hope to work out. I get that a lot of people do it. We're about to be entering a recession. It's about to become incredibly more common. And again, because from the business standpoint, there's no risk. These guys failed. I didn't have to pay them. But if it works, I hit the lottery. So from a business perspective, I see the allure of doing it. It's just a bad way to do business and a really good way to ruin your culture. So on the next side, people who are trained, they're doing well, and we move them up to manager. Being in sales and being a manager, very different skill sets. I mean, incredibly different. So let's specify here. When I'm talking about sales, going back to that funnel before, this is going to be about people who are interacting, getting the contracts going back and forth, and money coming across. So the skill sets there require a lot of being able to talk to people, relate to them, and to get them to feel an urgency and a desire to move forward. Because most sales ultimately die upon apathy rather than a competitor. Like, do I really need to do this? Do I really want to do this? Maybe, maybe not. And then they kick it down the road. It's like a dentist. We kick it down the road. It stops hurting. Oh, now my tooth's on fire and it needs pulled out. Now I actually need to do something. And that person I need is in a completely different stratosphere than where you were. So you weren't able to make it happen because you didn't create the urgency to come in for your routine checkup today. Now you're going to a dental surgeon. Well, that's what a lot of failed sales ultimately end up becoming. So the skill set of getting people through there, being urgent, being on top of your game, having communication, being able to dive into the pain that your customer has about why we need to create a relationship together and why you need to be paired up with me, and we're going to be able to make good harmony together. That is not the same skills as someone who is working for you and teaching them how to be efficient. And this goes into partially because that process of urgency works really important with your customers. It doesn't work with employees. Employees need consistency more than urgency. And oftentimes, whenever a salesperson is creating this urgency, it is in a one-time situation or in a relationship starting situation to shake them into action, shake your customer into action. But your sales force, your employees are already in action. They're already here working for you. And to constantly just keep shaking them eventually just makes them not want to be there. What is needed is stable consistency. This is our message. This is what we're doing. And this is training of how we can do it. And on that training front, it's oftentimes people that are the best at something can't really articulate why they are. Why are they the best at it? Wayne Gretzky, best hockey player of all time, one of the worst coaches of all time. He just couldn't teach people how to do it. And you're the great one. Like, literally, like, how are you not able to do this? It's a human nature thing. We don't really know why. There are psychologists out there trying to figure out that problem now. It's perplexing, but it's a different skill set at the end of the day between managing people and being a good salesperson. And very few have the crossover skills to be able to do it.
Just on there, Wayne Gretzky, because loads of people know the statement that he meant, to, you know, go where the puck is. But I listened on in his master class, and he said he got it was his dad said that to him. So it, you know, people are kind of crediting him for something he said, and it was actually someone else. And there's other things that I've come across that a lot of people are regurgitating things, and it was never true.
And yes, that is true.
It's been on stage as well. Like there's a lot of things they were saying, given some Harvard, I forget the exact one, but it was like talking about some Harvard report and it never happened. And somebody just said it and it's being repeated so many times on the stage.
Yeah, well, people repeat what they want to hear. I mean, that's part of human nature for your selection bias. And it's not really until you're hit with a lot of factual reality until you overcome it. I forget what the study was, but I want to say it was something like lies can travel 10 times faster than the truth. And it's based upon that notion. People just want to repeat what they want to hear, whether or not it's actually true, especially in a world where there's less actual physical contact with each other. It becomes much easier.
And with the coaching then, are you coaching kind of business leaders or what, what kind? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we deal with these types of problems. Like we walk into a space here and say, hey, Joe, I have a really great product, but no one on my team is on board with it. Like I can't get my people motivated to want to be engaged in this company and to want to be a part of it. It feels like they're just showing up for a paycheck and, you know, it's really holding us back. And I mean, that's incredibly common. I mean, welcome to the world. And what happens is this is normally people who created something on their own and they didn't know exactly how to do the managing side. They just expected everyone to be as professional as they are. And that's not really the case. There's lots of ways of how to solve that problem, but the easiest one is to figure out your compensation method. And because people will go in the way that you are leading them to go. So if I get paid more money to do what you want, I'm going to do what you want. If I get paid more money or the same amount of money, I'm going to go to the path of least resistance. And if that means not being productive for your business and giving the impression I don't care, that's what's going to happen. So as an analogy, say that you were in charge of a hotel. And the thing that you care about is I want my rooms to be clean and I want them to be clean on time for check-in. Those are my two primary cares from your position as the housekeeping staff. Well, we could do the traditional route of we're just going to pay everyone hourly, hope that it's clean enough, and hope that you're going fast enough. Well, from the employee's standpoint, they actually get paid more if they go slower. So we have a starting point contradiction. And as long as they're not getting yelled at on the cleanliness, there's no real incentive to take it to the max. It's just to keep it good enough. So what do you end up with? You end up with slow law. And a lot of us are dealing with that problem. I mean, that's not awesome. So how could we fix that? Well, we just basically say, here's the deal. I don't care how long you guys are here. I'm going to pay you based upon this scale. An A plus equals this, a B equals this, so on and so forth. And when you're done with your rooms, we're going to go through and evaluate them. And we're going to do simple math. You did this many A's, this many B's, this many C's, this is what you get paid for today. And then guess what? You get two things happening. You have just empowered that employee to figure out the best way to do it. Maybe instead of doing every room one at a time, she's doing four rooms in a little block, does all the bathrooms first, does all the bedding second, or whatever her systems. Every person will figure out their own unique way. As a manager, do you really care? No, you care about the end quality and the time it took to get there. So you've empowered someone, which automatically empowering someone makes them more invested. It is just a fact of life. You empower them, they're going to be more invested. They're going to be able to get better results. And at the end of the day, you look at your hourly rate you're paying people. Because they're not going to be there as long, your hourly rate is going to be stupid. It's going to be like five times what you were paying someone in some cases. But at the end of the day, you're getting exactly what you wanted and your total amount out of your pocket is roughly the same. So you have also accomplished the people who don't want to play on that platform will take themselves out. So the ones that were just mauling along, doing the bare minimum, hoping not to get yelled at, they will phase themselves out. Because if you're just doing below the line quality, you're barely going to get paid anything, and you're not going to want to stay there. You'll go to the other hotel that's paying on the old compensation package. And ultimately, that is an easy way to instantly create better results for you as a manager, but also get buy-in from your employees and get a better culture overall. And it just requires you to have enough faith in your people to empower them. And unfortunately, there's a lot of egotistical managers that will never even listen to what I said because they're afraid to do that.
Yeah, and I think it's excellent advice what you've just said. And the thing is, once it's kind of set up, you'll have less turnover as well, because once everybody's happy, why would you move?
Exactly. I'm here. I'm getting paid way more on an hourly rate than I would be before, and I get to go home sooner. I mean, who's leaving that gig?
Exactly. So just finally, because social media is a bit of a minefield, and I know, like, you know, you can hire the different organizations to do different things, but with all the different hats that you've got on, obviously the podcasting, the speaking, and the whole lot, what's your go-to social media? Because, you know, there's so many of them out there.
Yeah, I mean, I outsource it. I'm not going to lie. I make my partners do it. It's not my field. I don't like being behind a computer typing things out and figuring out all those keywords to get people to search for me. I just up front, I put that into the category of having people find you. And that's just not my personality type. I know that about me, and that's fine. I got partners that want to do that. They don't want to do what I'm doing. And that's why it's a good relationship. So, incredible value in it. I'm not trying to diminish it at all. It is a great way to find and cultivate an audience. One of the ways that we did it through was using YouTube Shorts as a social media platform, which is one of the most profitable ones we did for Local Football Flavor. You know, you make a 30-second to a 60-second sound clip, and it gets shared like crazy. I mean, it's amazing how successful those programs have been. And I mean, obviously, I'm involved in the making of them and distributing them. But in terms of the market research and then doing the follow-up tweets and the follow-up on all that other stuff, Instagram and all that, I outsource all of it. But I do know from a direct result of it works, and it works if you stay on it consistently. The issue is it's time-consuming, right? So a lot of people don't want to do it because it's time-consuming, because they don't see immediate results from it. It's a long play. And in general, things that you don't want to do but you know that are important, you need to allocate to someone that will do it. Because if it's important and you're not going to do it, you're going to miss out from it. And eventually that missing out from it is going to wear on you, either in the back of your mind going, I should be doing this, like I should be studying for that test next week, but you really don't, and then you're forced cramming it. But in the modern economy, those customers can't be crammed. You know, that doesn't exist. You need to be doing the work constantly, and the marketing of through social media is one of those things. So what I would recommend is if you don't have a partner who can do it, or if you don't have someone on your staff who can do it, find a company that will, and have a good relationship with them. Because the other part is you want to make sure it's quality that's coming out on your behalf. If you can do it in-house, all the better, but you need to find someone that you really trust to be able to carry your message in your brand. And what I recommend with that is find the team that's actually going to be working on your personal account that most resembles your soul of your business. And, you know, for those who are in startups, it probably starts with the soul of the actual entrepreneur who's creating it, because that's inevitably going to bleed upon everything else. You know, all of our good and our bad will come out. So what I advise people to do is find someone who mirrors you and is comfortable in that space. And then the rest of it will take care of itself, because your customers ultimately want to have a relationship to you. And the more authentic you are in knowing of yourself, the more that they can find you.
Excellent. And I've heard it's something that I'm actually planning on doing myself with the shorts. I don't know, they got reels or shorts with the YouTube. And does that just appear for like a day or something and then it's gone? Or does it go into your YouTube chat? But it counts as a view, does it?
Oh, it absolutely. So it counts as a view. It does go back to your channel. But in reality, it's put out there as the new shiny thing. People can click on it. And then after that, it has to be found via search. It doesn't really get re-upticked again unless you're using it through Google Ads and pumping it out there by paying money to have it circulate longer, which, you know, some things do. And then obviously, if it catches wildfire, Google will let it live forever, because Google wants people to stay on it. And that's the most important thing with, you know, you get north of 50,000 views, it has a much longer lifespan than if it only has 2,000 views. And that's just because Google knows it's successful and we're going to keep giving it to people who's there. And the other part is, at least what I love with YouTube, is you get immediate results. Because once you get to enough subscribers, and it's not even a lot, it's only like 200, Google will then basically know exactly who your audience is, and they will target them for you. And that is one of the best things about YouTube that gets missed in the equation. People often will complain, well, they don't start giving me checks until I hit these really hard limits. And starting off, they're daunting. To have 4,000 hours of views and 1,000 subscribers, that's a scary number up front. It does scare a lot of people away. But you're also getting this benefit of them finding the audience for you that should be there. You just need to stick with it enough and keep producing content. Now, there's other ways you can do to make YouTube much more efficient and work for you in terms of writing good descriptions, having good, you know, titles, all that fun stuff, all the metadata you have to do. But there is value in putting some effort into YouTube, particularly, I believe, more so than some of the other directories, mostly because of the search engine of Google that is behind YouTube.
Excellent. No, perfect. Excellent advice. So, Joe, you might let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way to find me is going to be at elitebusinessconversations.com. If you have any questions about either me presenting for you or your group in a keynote presentation, you can find the links in there, as well as all of our business consulting information.
Yeah, excellent. I'll make sure I put the link both in the audio and the video. Thank you very much, Joe.
Perfect. Thank you.
So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. That's nice. Brian Bitch on YouTube. And I'm a coach as well, so you'll find everything on bio.link/podcaster. Be sure to give it a 5-star rating, thumbs up, and also give a 5-star rating to Joe's podcast. It all helps. He'd like to get further up the charts as well. Until next week, take care.